Welcome back to the program. Columbine, Virginia Tech, Northern Illinois University, Cleveland High School all conjure up painful images of boys gone bad. We've all heard the teacher or the neighbor talk about what a good student or a nice boy some of these perpetrators were. But nice boys, normal boys, don't kill their fellow students or themselves. So what happened? Can we really ever fully understand what goes on inside the minds of these boys and what they tell us about ourselves? Perhaps Caesar was right. The fault is in ourselves. Few have looked deeper into this abyss than our guest this morning, novelist and journalist David Vann. David is the internationally best-selling author of Caribou Island, A Mile Down, and A Legend of Suicide. He's also a National Endowment for the Arts Fellow and a Wallace Stegner Fellow. He taught at Stanford, Cornell, and Florida State Universities. It is my pleasure to welcome David Vann back to this program to talk about his newest work, Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter. David Vann, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. First of all, David, talk a little bit about how you came to this story. It originally started as a piece you did, a lengthy piece for Esquire, at a time when this was a case, this was a kid, Stephen Kaczmarczyk, that people just couldn't quite understand.
Right. He had been a straight-A student and a Dean's Award winner, and for everyone who knew him at the time, his professors and other students, they couldn't make sense of how this could have happened. They couldn't link the Steve that they knew with the shooter who came in and killed five students and himself and wounded 18. So initially I had contacted Esquire and asked to write a story about how armed suburban youth are. After my father killed himself with a pistol when I was 13, my family gave me all of his guns and thought that was a good idea. So I had a 12-gauge shotgun, a 20-gauge shotgun, a 30-30 rifle like in the Westerns, and a 300 Magnum with a scope, a rifle meant for bears. And I was using those guns at night, sneaking around our neighborhood, aiming at people through their living room windows with the scope, shooting out street lamps, and I led a kind of double life. I was a straight-A student by day, and at night I was out with these guns. And the guns were a kind of terrible substitute for a couple of years. And instead of going to therapy or dealing with my father's suicide in any way, I just shot things. So when my editor heard that story, he thought I should look into the school shooting because he saw parallels. And indeed, in the book, I include parts of my own memoir right. to try to understand him and keep him close and not make him a monster and try to figure out how his life and his final action implicates us and the larger culture and how close my life came to his life.
And what's so remarkable is how little people knew, particularly people at the university, how little they knew about what was really going on with him.
Yeah, he had reinvented himself for the last 5 years. I mean, really his story is this story of a junior high and high school experience and then mental health history afterward in mental health institutions. It was really terrible. I mean, a really frightening kind of life that was perfectly shaped for mass murder and has all the warning signs you could want to possibly find. But then he reshaped his life, and he had this tremendous drive for success, and he wanted not to become a school shooter. He actually wanted to reshape himself and become something different. And then, and he mostly succeeded at that, but then he regressed at the end as he went through some transitions. His mother died, he switched to a different university, he's very anxious about all the changes and what he's going to do with his life, and during that time he slipped back to who he had been, to that person whose life was perfectly shaped for mass murder.
It was also clear that when you looked back at his early life, that there was a lot of serious depression and mental illness going on. He had been to therapists, he had been on Prozac, he had been on other drugs. There was a lot of serious issues going on.
Yeah. One thing, I was very lucky. I was able to get the full 1,500 pages of the police file. I have all the information about him. So I have all of his mental health history, including all of the notes that therapists made when they saw him. I have his emails in the book. You can actually read his emails that he had with his friends right toward the end. His military history, his juvenile record, interviews with everyone. So it's this mountain of information, and it's very disturbing, his earlier mental health history. He had half a dozen times that he tried to kill himself. At the end, he was able to buy firearms because the card that does a background check so that you can buy firearms only checks 5 years. And he had reinvented himself for these 5 years, so no one around him could see warning signs. He could legally buy firearms. You know, there was a kind of gap. But when you go back to those earlier records, he's on a whole range of medications. It's hard to know which symptoms are his and which belong to the medications. Like early on when he was taking lithium and some other drugs, he pumped up to about 300 pounds after he had been very skinny before that, and he did that in just a couple months. So he kind of transforms on, in the mental health system and under all the drugs, and it gets tougher to link his life to mine during that time and harder to understand him. He kind of goes off the map a little bit.
One of the other themes that runs throughout this story is his relationships, such as they were, with women.
Right. Sexual despair was a big part of what made his shooting possible in the end. He was gay and in denial of being gay or bi. He might have liked to be with both. Over time, he was with a lot of women, only a few men. And at the very end, he was really exhausting himself with sex. He was having sex with multiple prostitutes in the same night. And it was a big part of what made the shooting possible. In the book, what I do is I take the half a dozen maybe primary narratives in his life that made it possible for him to do this killing, possible to put him going into that classroom at the end. But I can't make it inevitable, really. I can't say that, you know, these are the things that made it so he had to do it. He actually sat in his car right at the end and almost didn't do it. If he had waited just maybe 2 minutes more, it would have been too late. Everyone would have been gone. But one of the most consistent patterns that makes it possible at the end is that sexual despair from early on, where he had sex with a couple men in high school. He may have been abused. He had a summer of secret sex that was very shameful early on. And at the end, he was exhausting himself with prostitutes.
Talk about his relationship, his last relationship with his last quote-unquote girlfriend, Jessica.
Yeah, Jessica Beatty was the one person in his life who could have put all the warning signs together. She had the full information of the, you know, the people who knew him at the end of his life. None of them had the full information except for her. But she had her own mental health issues, and she loved him and was kind of blinded by that. And that relationship was one that turned into just a friendship. She still wanted it to be more, but he just wanted to be friends. At the end, he gave her an engagement ring and other gifts that she was to open on Valentine's Day. And so she was expecting a proposal on Valentine's Day, that he would come back home, and he was just away on trip for a few days, and she believed that he would propose. They would be getting married. And instead, he ended up committing mass murder on that day. So even though she lied to me a lot in the interviews and is the one person who could have seen warning signs, she certainly has my sympathy for her, how awful that surprise must have been for her. Imagine thinking you're getting married and instead it turns out he's committing mass murder that day.
What did she lie about?
Everything. She said that he was a very private person. He wouldn't have wanted all of this known about him. Because in the book, there's all this embarrassing stuff, like that he had sex with a dog, that he had mm-hmm. sex with multiple prostitutes, you know, all the stuff that he would have wanted to hide. And so she wanted to protect him. He told her all kinds of creepy things, like, for instance, something may happen and don't tell anyone about me. And he said some things to her kind of indicating what was going to happen. And so I don't think she was protecting herself, though. I think she just really loved him and thought he was a private person and didn't want to have him exposed. And so she lied about everything that she possibly could. She knew that I didn't know very much at first. Like everyone else, I thought he was a sweet student, graduate student who just suddenly snapped. And on CNN, when she gave an interview a few days after the event, that's what she said. You know, she said, no, Steve couldn't have done this. This isn't the kind of person he was. But, of course, he was that kind of person, and his life was shaped for that, and she actually had all that information. She knew it.
His flirtation with guns and various kinds of weapons goes back, really, to his youngest days. You talk about his what he did with pellet guns and the Drano bombs and even the way he treated the family dog.
Right. He threw the family dog against the wall because it had kind of loud breathing, and that really annoyed him. One of his friends reported seeing him have sex with the dog, looking through his bedroom window, and that may have just been a story, but Steve told other friends that he was He didn't say that he didn't have sex with the dog. He just said that he was teaching it dominance, which is not the same as denying the story. It's very strange, those early times. What was important about those early times is that he became separated from his friends, kind of ostracized from the group several different times. And that kind of isolation from friends and family is part of what makes the shooting possible in the end. In the end, he wasn't really in touch with anyone, and he'd had kind of really bitter fallouts with his family. And was becoming more and more isolated and interested in guns, horror movies, online shooter games. Was on medication and such. Was reading about other shooters. There's a mountain of facts in the book, but I have to admit, at the end of 3 months of interviews and then the 1,500 pages of files and everything, you know, it was kind of dark and depressing. And it was also depressing about what it says about American culture, because it turns out we're implicated in so many ways. He was a libertarian, which all the school shooters are, and there are a lot of libertarians in America. All of our shooters, who are old enough to have served in the military, have, because the military teaches you to kill without psychological or emotional response. He enjoyed watching the Saw movies, and tens of millions of Americans enjoy watching people be tortured in the Saw movies without any emotional or psychological connection. You know, it was kind of horrific, actually, to start thinking about how many Americans are at risk who have served in the military, been in the mental health system, like horror movies, or libertarians, struggling financially, not sure what to do with their lives. It's actually very frightening.
I mean, one of the things you talk about is growing up, his relationship with his mother. They would watch horror movies together. And you say that the thing that animated their life, their living room, was the combination of horror movies and the Bible.
Yeah, you know, the Bible is, religion has a strange connection to horror movies, which is that it teaches us that the flesh is of no consequence. If this mortal life doesn't matter, and it's only the afterlife that matters, then things like torture and such, actually, I mean, I agree, this is a completely screwed up view of religion. Like, this is not what any church that I know of is advocating, but there is this strange connection with the tortures of Job, for instance, and many other stories, where there really is an idea that the flesh is of no consequence, that it doesn't matter, and there's a kind of removal from suffering and from identifying with the suffering of a victim, and that's the pattern that he seemed to pick up in all of these things, in his military training, in the horror movies, in his religious background. So it's a warping of what was intended in that religion, but it did fit together.
Why didn't the military pick up any of this?
They did. The military knew exactly how dangerous he was. They knew that he was a danger to himself and others, and they actually kept him locked up in a psychiatric ward, and then they dumped him in his hometown in Illinois and didn't alert anyone. They didn't let anyone know, and that's what the military does over and over and over. They take people they know are a danger to themselves and others, and they just dump them in society and tell no one after they've trained them to kill without any psychological or emotional response. And this is why all of our killers who are old enough to have served in the military have.
Why did they take him in the first place? I mean, how did he get past the initial testing to get in the military?
Well, it turns out there's really just no initial testing and no checking of the application form when you get into the military. He had a terrible mental health history, but on the forms he said he didn't have a terrible mental health history, and they didn't bother to check until after he'd already finished basic training and had been assigned somewhere. And then they finally did the check and found out that he had this awful history, and that's why they kicked him out and dumped him in his hometown. But they'll just kind of take anyone, you know. They're not real careful. I mean, supposedly there's supposed to be requirements, what they call blueprinting, where they think about, you know, if you have health problems or major issues, but they don't do careful background checks initially.
Talk a little bit about the events that led immediately up to the shooting. This wasn't something random. He planned this. And you talk about how the night before he pulled the SIM card out of his phone, he hid the hard drives from his computer. He knew what he was doing.
Right, that's where he becomes a monster. In the book, I tried to not have him become a monster. I tried to think about how my life was similar to his and keep him as close as possible. But by the end, when he plans it ahead of time, 11 days in advance, and he's still chipper in his emails with his friends and joking, and you know that he's planning mass murder at this point, that's where he really does become a monster, because he's planning to do all this to all these people and still is moving along apparently in this jokey kind of fine way with his life. That's where I stopped understanding him. So 11 days before, there was a shooting in Chicago, a department store robbery that went wrong. The killer ended up shooting four or five women execution style, and that was the event that Steve found exciting in his warped state of mind and pushed him over the edge to commit his event. And the shooters are all like this. The shooters study each other, and they're spurred on by events. It's not a copycat exactly, but it's a kind of inspiration from seeing someone else do something. They actually buy from the same suppliers, too. He bought from the same online gun supplier that the VA tech shooter used, and he used the same weapon, the Glock 19, a pistol that's meant to kill a bunch of people in a short period of time, very reliably at close range. The same weapon that killed most of the victims in VA Tech and was also used in Tucson in that shooting. So it's not actually that hard to profile these shooters. They're actually really similar, and they study each other, and they plan ahead, and they buy all their stuff in advance. But we have nothing in place to stop that or even to track it. To check firearms only goes back 5 years, and we don't track the online purchases of firearm stuff.
Did he know he was going to kill himself?
Yeah, he had had half a dozen suicide attempts, and he planned this whole thing out to last just a couple minutes, less than 3 minutes, because he knew that he had studied school shootings, and he knew that the police response plan would be different than VA Tech. In VA Tech and Columbine, the police were just idiotic and horrible in their response. In Columbine, they waited for hours. A teacher finally bled out and died because they were so slow in getting in there. In VA Tech, they didn't respond. He did two series of shootings. He did one, and then he wasn't caught or anything, so he went ahead and did a second round. So because of that, school policies have changed where police go in right away, even if they don't have backup, and Steve knew all that. So he planned to have it take place in just a couple minutes. So we can't really guard against it in that way. Since we don't have more reasonable gun laws generally, there's no way that universities can become islands and somehow protect themselves. Their response plans are just responding to an aftermath. They can't actually prevent the shooting.
Was he also a racist?
He was, and that was cut out of the Esquire article. But his racism, I think, is important because it's part of that libertarian political philosophy of the small group or individual against the larger society and the government. And part of his anger at that government came from a racist feeling that the various incentive programs and such for students were giving too much advantage to African-American students. So he's very angry, as most libertarians are, at federal government spending on social services and anything that might be related to race.
Was there, or did you find anywhere, a single moment, a tipping point, that this end was inevitable for him?
It was a slide that actually took about three-quarters of a year. There wasn't one moment. The first thing was the death of his mother. He was switching also from one school to another, which is tough for someone with mental health issues to make transitions. He was leaving all of his friends and the professors he knew and the program he was comfortable with, going to another program. What was awful was that his last semester of classes at the previous school, which was NIU, where the shooting took place, he returned to his old school to do the shooting. His last semester of classes there wouldn't count for the grades or credits because he was moving to a new program somewhere else. So he just went to the shooting range instead of going to school. Instead of getting straight A's, he suddenly got F's. And he studied the VA Tech shooting, which happened during that time, and just shot things. The guns became a kind of substitute. So that began his slide, the kind of unresolved past with his mother and anger at her that was now unresolved because she was dead, the difficulty in moving to a different school. He focused on guns and horror movies. He became isolated from his friends and other family. And it was a slow slide. It took a while. It took about maybe 9 months or something to head toward the shooting.
And once he was on that path, it speeded up dramatically in terms of what he was doing.
Yeah, he at the end, he went off Prozac 2 weeks before, which is an important factor because he had gone off Prozac in the fall and had an increase in all of his symptoms when he did that, which a lot of people experience going on or off of Prozac the first 2 weeks or last two, first 2 weeks on or last 2 weeks, you know, after going off of it are the most dangerous times. And he also was trying to get back into the military because he realized that that structured life was what he needed, that it was too anxious for him to try to figure out what else to do with his life. He needed daily structure and control. He was separated from his friend Jessica Beatty, who had been his girlfriend, and was online a lot, doing a lot of online dating, and then exhausting himself with sex with prostitutes toward the end, you know, studying shooters. He was ramping up toward the event becoming possible, but it was really, it was that other shooting that took place in Chicago that finally clicked and made something happen. And so it was 11 days before, and February 3rd is when he actually made the decision and started doing all the online purchases at that same place that the VA Tech shooter had used.
Did he have any close personal male friends?
He did. He had two, and one of them I spent a lot of time talking with. I have a three-hour taped conversation with him, for instance, and he provided a lot of info. And it was interesting talking with him because I could see how he and Steve talked, because the way he talks about Steve now is the way that they previously had talked about the VA Tech shooter and other shooters. They talk about their success, for instance, you know, if they've killed a lot of people, and they talk about their methodology. You know, all this is ludicrous. There is no methodology. In the U.S., we have no gun control whatsoever, and anyone can go buy a Glock 19, buy a bunch of ammo, extra clips, and go shoot people like they're fish in a barrel. You know, there's not a methodology to it. It's a carefully protected American right to use weapons of mass murder, you know, as we're supposedly just thinking about, you know, militias guarding against our federal government or home protection. We have weapons like Glock 19 that are meant to kill a whole bunch of people in a short period of time. So they would talk about these things together. And so as I'm sitting there talking with his best friend, he's now talking about Steve in the same weirdly distanced way. In other words, there's no emotion shown whatsoever in this friend that his friend is now dead and is a mass murderer. He's just interested in how Steve did it. He just wants to think about, gosh, that's so cool that he used this gun and then that gun and what he was able to do. That what's most frightening to me and most consistent in this story is a remove psychologically and emotionally. That's what's true in the military training. It's true in watching the horror movies. It was true for Steve, at least in his religious background. It's true of the political ideology of libertarianism, and it's true in his friends and how they think about and talk about these shooters.
David Vann, the book is Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.